Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast with me, yours truly, Simone, another fellow Nutcracker Syndrome patient that just underwent my auto transplant. We are two, wait, what's the math on this? Dear goodness. I'm about to tell you that I'm a professor and I teach students, and here I can't do simple math. So LOL. The 19th, we're 3 days away. 3 days away from my 4 month post kidney auto transplant. So that's really exciting. I have been sitting on, as some of y'all know, I've been posting obviously in the Facebook group about doing a mental games tidbit episode, and I've been like getting in my own head. I've been, as a psych professor, I've been psyching myself out. I love this. Because I really obviously want to do well by you all. This has been such a labor of love project that has helped me. I mean, first and foremost, just continue to process my journey. And I'm always somebody who does want to give back. And this podcast has really been helping me. And I, of course, I did it because I want to help the community. I mean, I remember feeling so lost when I was diagnosed and the amount of overwhelm. And obviously, that contributes that. That contributes to the mental overwhelm, the like absolute mental deep dive into that deep, dark depression and anxiety hole that probably all of us have either been in at some point. I know I was in it majorly, to the point of like I was in mental health therapy, but I was also supplementing with anti-anxiety meds. I mean, I was doing the whole thing. I was meditating, I was going to the sauna, I was throwing everything but the kitchen's at the kitchen sink that I could, and I still struggled. So I just want to normalize for you all that this is a really hard road, and there's no real blueprint on how to manage. So the biggest thing I could just say out the gate is to be compassionate with yourself, give yourself what you need for the day. I think that was something I learned heavily, heavily through this process, is going slower, being more compassionate with myself, really catching myself when I say should to, have to, ought to. But what I decided is, again, I stopped psyching myself out, and I thought, you know what? Specifically, I'm a sports psychology and coaching professor, for graduate level students, for master's and doctorate. Level students that are pursuing either an applied sports psychology degree or a coaching degree, which I love my job. I love, love, love teaching, which to some degree is why I think I love doing this podcast. I'm going to break up these mental game tidbit episodes into a couple different parts. This first part, this episode here, I really want to set the stage. I think once you can kind of understand like where you're at in the process and what happens psychologically, and the stress injury model, things like that. So I teach a psychology of injury course, and it's specifically sport injury. But and I'm actually in the middle of teaching this class now. So we just started the term just a couple weeks ago. So this information is fresh on my mind. And I thought, you know what? Let me give you all a free lesson. And bring the content from this class, especially the introductory portion of it, and then we can jump into like part twos and maybe part three. We'll kind of see how this spans out. I'm just going with the flow here and give you all hope that you all can walk away feeling like, okay, I at least have some next steps I can do that make me feel like I'm more capable of wrapping my mind around this mentally. So for this episode, I'm going to talk about two separate things. I'm going to talk about two separate models. So the first model is a three-phase model, and it's what we talk about. So specifically, I'm doing psychology of sport injury. But what I tell the students all the time, I actually share very intimately my story of getting diagnosed with Nutcracker, its effect on me being able to even be a recreational athlete, even being able to just go to the gym. I wasn't able to do that for a year. And how you might, these students who might be going into the sport arena play or working with and consulting with athletes specifically, they, yes, might sustain a sport-specific injury such as tearing their ACL, things of that nature. However, they could also work with a client and have an athlete who gets a rare diagnosis like this. Like, nobody's safe from this diagnosis. So it could be a diagnosis that didn't necessarily wasn't sustained in sport, but affects sport participation. So I'll be talking about two different models today that, even though they're specific to sport, they very much have come alive for me within my Nutcracker journey. I will specifically be talking about my Nutcracker journey in these specific models. The first one being the three-phase model, and then the second one being the stress injury model. So, for starters, this three-phase. Wow, I'm gonna take a little sip of my coffee here. If you're drinking your coffee, take a little sip with me. Get my words about me here. Okay. The three-phase model, and to me, this helped me understand, like, okay, where am I at in the injury model itself? So in the diagnosis model. So this is a how people cognitively react to an injury. So there's phase one is your reaction to injury. So this again, it's an initial psychological response to the injury itself, which is heavily influenced by the physical characteristics of the injury. So, the type of injury, the location, the history of this injury. So, like, think time, the severity of it as well. So, like, for me, I will forever remember July 25th, 2024. There is no way I can forget it. I remember going in and sitting down. I went in thinking I was going to get a simple Mayþerner syndrome diagnosis, pop a stent in that baby, and we get on with our lives. It was going to fix everything. And I remember the nurse practitioner that I saw was telling me about Mayþerner, and then she transitioned into telling me about Nutcracker. I hadn't been diagnosed yet. They hadn't brought my scans out to say, oh, the interventional radiologist looked at your scans and this is what you have. Now let's talk to you about it. And I remember vividly thinking, God, Nutcracker sucks, and I'm so glad we don't think I have that. Even though I was having left flank pain, I was just like, I've had kidney stones before. And then they proceeded to say, you have, it's a little, it's inconclusive. We think you do have Mayþerner, but we can't really tell on the CT. But your CT very much shows a severe case of Nutcracker syndrome. And I remember going, oh, okay. And then a second later, I just felt this overwhelming like heat enter my body and I just started crying. And the nurse practitioner, I think I shock a lot of people when I cry because I have a very stoic mentality about me, especially when I'm in intense pain, I get even more stoic. So she looked at me a little like, oh, and she was like, oh, yeah, this is a really hard diagnosis to get. She was very encouraging. And then I proceeded to be in shock for 48 hours. And I didn't realize I was in shock actually until I was diagnosed on a Thursday. And I go home and tell Kyle about it. I remember being emotional telling him because I was having to relive the diagnosis through his eyes. And then I just went into shock. And then Saturday morning rolls around and we do what we call a bed-to-bed transfer, where we transferred from the bed upstairs to the couch bed we have downstairs. And I just couldn't stop crying. It was like I had just this geyser had opened up and I could not. I was like, I don't know. And I kept going, I don't know what's wrong with me today. I must be on my period. And he was like, you just got the diagnosis of a lifetime. And I was like, that's true. Okay. So that's the reaction to injury. It's that very acute, like the diagnosis itself. And I wanted to give that detail to you because you might be sitting here thinking, like maybe brushing that under the rug when there's a lot that goes into the first time you're told you have Nutcracker syndrome. Whether it's via a CT, whether it's via the venogram, whatever it might be, that comes with a lot of baggage. Because I was told in that meeting, actually before that appointment, before I was diagnosed, I remember her saying, there's a couple different surgical options, but the most successful ones are losing your kidney or relocating it. And I'm like, we're talking about a transplant. And I remember being like, man, that sucks for those people. LOL. And then here I'm one of those people. So that's the reaction to injury is the type of injury that we're dealing with a potential transplant. The location of it is severe in the sense of like mine was a full open abdominal surgery. I know for some that you can get robotic, like with Dr. Pashak. The history of it too, like I had been dealing with 2 years of just pretty major medical stuff, multiple surgeries, and the PTSD that I had there too. We'll get into that in a little bit when we get into that stress injury model. And then the severity of it. Right, like we're staring down the barrel of a very severe surgery, one that I'm gonna have to take FMLA for. Some of you all I know don't have the privilege of that, and my heart goes out to you. Again, I'm speaking about my soloed live experience that isn't a one-to-one ratio to you all. And what that means is some of you are working an hourly job. So the thought of having to maybe travel and be away from your job for 3 to 4 weeks is like, I can't financially afford that. I mean, that was Kyle, my caregiver, my partner. Weirdly, it almost worked out. He was without a job. It was at the time, he's a seasonal worker. And it weirdly worked out that everything fell on a time during Christmas when like people weren't really hiring for jobs anyways. So that was one of the reasons why we're like, we have to take this December 19th date, because it actually worked out. But it was really stressful because we thought, what if this falls on a time where Kyle has to take off and he can't do that? You know, we were trying to look at my finances and maybe like, oh my gosh. So the reaction to being diagnosed with Nutcracker syndrome is massive, is what I'm trying to say. It's the type severe. The history of how you even got to this, it's not like you just walked into the ER one day and got the diagnosis right out the gate. I mean, if you did, you're a lucky son of a bitch, you know. The location, I mean, we're talking about a full body transformation. So that's phase one, is that reaction to injury. And whatever your reaction was is wholesome, it is right, it is valid. And I'm going to say this a million times. I think everybody going through Nutcracker, if, and I know accessibility is a thing, as much as you can, seek out therapy. Call your insurance. If you have it, ask about in-network therapist because there's a lot that you're holding. So phase one is the reaction to the diagnosis and all that comes with it. Phase two is the reaction to rehabilitation. Now, the reaction to injury is kind of that acute phase. And then there's like a no person land, it feels like, because we all know that the reaction to rehabilitation, let me back up a little bit. So, phase two, this occurs parallel to the physiological phase of repair, which typically means the decrease in physical injury complications and requires engagement in rehab activities aimed at increasing strength and balance and mobility. Okay. So your reaction to injury, the reaction to the diagnosis happens. So that was July 25th, 2024 for me. And then there's this like barren land of depression and anxiety, self-hatred, suicidal ideation. Let's talk about it. I was heavy there. Because you're fighting to even get to phase two, because phase two happens like when the surgery happens and you're able to come back and rehabilitate. But we all know that that's months. I am, and I'm gonna throw this out there. I got really lucky. And I can't even say like, oh, I got lucky because X, Y, and Z. I can't even tell you a formula. Like, I just really call it manifesting it, whatever. Obviously, I was diagnosed July 25th, 2024. I had a couple doctors really downplay the Nutcracker syndrome because when I had my venogram on August 9th of 2024, the Nutcracker, we thought it was very severe. It was only moderate. It was a 48% compression with no pressure gradient, and there was only one measly, very weak-looking collateral vein in my spine, which later actually I think was the real winner, the real advocate for me even getting an auto transplant. So my interventional radiologist downplayed my Nutcracker very much. Your Mathurner stent is going to fix everything, blah blah blah. I intuitively just was like, I don't know, I don't want to wait around until my Nutcracker does get too bad. Like a moderate compression and the fact that my blood is not 100% flowing like it should, I don't like it. I don't like it. So I am going to pursue this on my own. So my intuition encouraged me to do that. So from July 25th, 2024 until December 19th, 2024, I had my auto transplant in December. So we're looking at August, September, October, November, December. So we're about 4.5, 5 months. So between phase one, your reaction to the diagnosis, to the reaction to rehabilitation, barren, depressed land where you're trying to figure it out. Obviously, I talked about during this time, helping you to manage your cognitive appraisal is collecting data, collecting as much data as you can. I mentioned this, I think it was in episode 2, 3, 4, I forget. for what I did to help myself manage this barren land of depression, and maybe this is because I'm a researcher, I love data. The more data that I could gather and understand and help connect the dots, it helped me just to be able to take a bird's eye view of what was going on. So that was going and seeing a rheumatologist to see if I do actually have Ehlers-Danlos or not. For me, I was diagnosed as negative. I started doing acu excuse me, I started doing acupuncture weekly. I started doing gosh, I was going to physical therapy twice a week. I was getting massages weekly. Gosh, what else? I was doing went and got my renal Hiller block done to see what the outcome of that was, to give me some data. I went and did the nuclear medicine scan to see what is the split ratio of how my kidneys are functioning. So the more all of these things are what you can do. You could still advocate for yourself. And this was me absolutely going to my doctor saying, I need you to do this. It was never a doctor saying, we're going to do this for you. I did have for the nuclear medicine scan, I was working with UC Health in tandem with UW Health. They ordered the nuclear medicine scan for me after they got eyes on my scans. So there was a little bit of advocacy on their end, but do not expect that. Don't expect it. I mean, I made a list and I went into my primary care and I was like, can you do this for me? Or I went to my interventional radiologist, or sometimes I went to my gynecologist and was like, can you make this call and just send it this specific thing in? So those are things you can do between phase one and phase two. The reaction to rehabilitation, like I said, happens upon surgery. Once the surgery happens and now you're in rehabilitation phase. So like I said, we're coming up on 3 days away from my 4 month post-op, which is exciting. And it has been a little bit of a roller coaster. It's definitely been night and day. I feel a lot better. I have good energy. People, the most re the resounding feedback I get across multiple people is, wow, your face looks so different because I have blood pumping to it finally. Just my demeanor. I mean, they're just like, you look like a different person, and I feel like a different person. So obviously been f coming up on 4 months at the time of this recording since my kidney auto transplant, meaning that I'm currently in the phase two, the rehabilitation phase of this three-phase model. It's had its ups and downs, but again, overall, it's been going well. And to some degree, it's because I do feel like I've been cognitively appraising my healing process in a positive way. I've had surgeries prior where my body heals pretty well. I also make sure to intersect that with good nutrition. I started supplementing with testosterone. Obviously, as a female, that's a low dose, but that I definitely saw the benefits of that helping with healing. So the episode that I recorded that regarded the hormones and vascular compressions, if that's something that resonates with you, talk to your hormone specialist about potentially supplementing with testosterone. But I'm still building my body back to what it was as I was unable to work out, like I said, for an entire year prior to my auto transplant. So that's been challenging, having to take things slowly. For context, I'm an athlete. I am a very athletically built person. So my identity isn't as strong. Like, I don't have a very strong athletic identity, but I do have like kinesthetics and movement has been a massive part of my narrative my entire life. So there was a grieving portion of that when I got back into the gym and I was having to only lift like 3 pound weights, it's like, okay, we're really like, that was a bit of an ego boost, an ego hit for me. Not in a huge way, but just in a like, okay, be compassionate. This is where we're at. We're going to slowly build back. But the biggest thing that helped me through this process was really making sure to focus on the wins. So just focusing on the fact that, yes, I'm back in the gym and I can have a workout, even if it's with 3 pound weights, and I can walk away not hurting. This is amazing. This is so amazing. So my parameters for post-op recovery were, just so everybody knows, were no lifting of anything heavier than 8 pounds, which is the equivalent of a gallon of milk, and only walking for 3 full months. So no stair climber, which I love that thing, no biking. And I had my 3 month follow-up, obviously, almost a month ago, where I was released to phase two of healing, where I could then, they said, okay, now for the next 2 weeks, you can gauge You're released to do cardiovascular activities such as running, cycling, hiking, swimming. And now I had a weight restriction of 30 pounds for 2 weeks. And then if everything went well there, I could then go to 50 pounds for 2 weeks. And then after that, fully released from with no restrictions at all. So we're coming up on 3 days away from no restrictions. And I'm being honest with you, this phase two is hard because even though they're releasing you to do it, I had a day I went to the gym and I was like, ooh, I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good. And I did that 30 pound. I was probably more like 25 pounds, 25 to 30 pounds, especially on my legs, because, I got some thick, strong legs. And the next day, I just wasn't feeling great. It was just kind of an overall malaise, if you will. It wasn't like any targeted acute stuff. So, I took a couple of days off and I was like, okay, we're reeling it back. This was just my body telling me that we're not ready for this. And that's okay. Everybody's healing timeline is different. That's the challenging thing about this is you have your surgeon sitting there telling you, or the nurse practitioner being like, okay, you're released to do this. So it could be coupled with like when you do go do that and you're not better, you shame yourself like, oh, I should be released to do this. But again, I wasn't able to work out for an entire year. Some of you might be listening to this being like, I haven't worked out in 5 years because of this. So there's a lot of things you need to go slowly. I just went and worked out yesterday, and so this is going on. I got released a month ago to do 30. It's taken me that entire month. So we're almost at the 4 month mark to get to that 30 pounds where my body feels strong enough to do it. So I haven't even hit that 50 pound yet. So I just want to normalize some of that for you. I think a lot of things during this time is me, and I'll go into more specifics about techniques that you can use in each phase. I just want to talk about each one of these phases. But a massive thing that happened for me, and as some of you all know, I was doing the What Went Well campaign for a little while. That obviously I didn't continue doing that, but it's stuff I do with my positive psychology students about let's not forget that while shit is hitting the fan, there is still positives happening, even at the micro scale. Maybe it's that, I mean, we had a puppy and it was like he was learning these new skills. So I was like really looking at those wins, but also looking at the wins of my rehabilitation, of like the fact that I'm even able to go to the gym and do the sauna again. The fact that when I was able to submerge my body in water again, that was amazing. So some of the things I have been doing, and like again, we'll get into the nitty-gritty of them in future episodes, is taking these small wins and making sure that I'm approaching my body, being compassionate with my body with what it needs. Maybe that's doing a daily gratitude journal, where you denote all the good things that are going on around you, even on the low days. So that's, again, we talked about phase one is your reaction to injury. That can be, right, there's the acute reaction to injury, like the actual diagnosis and having to swallow that pill, and then the barren wasteland of depression until you can get the surgery to get into phase two, which I'm kind of in that phase two, but also phase three is the reaction to participation slash return to life. So this encompasses the cognitive appraisals and the emotional and behavioral reactions in response to your readiness to return to your life, to participating in anything. So you have the surgery, and obviously there's the rehabilitation. Like, think about that inpatient, like, you're definitely not returning to life. You're like very acutely there. And then phase two, these aren't really compartmentalized. It's not like, okay, check, you're in phase three now. Like, for me, I was phase one, barren wasteland of depression until I got to phase two when the surgery happened in December. And then when I was released from Madison, Wisconsin to come back to Colorado, I'm teetering on that phase two, phase three. Like, I am returning back to my life in Evergreen, Colorado, in our cabin, like doing things around the house. And what does that feel like to do chores? And me cognitively appraising that, that was really challenging because you get back and you're back in your home environment. And I kind of was like, okay, we're back and we can get back. And there were just things like, for example, bringing in the groceries. Well, that's heavier than an 8 pounds. So Kyle was having to do that. So it was still really challenging. I'm still teetering, still at this 4 month mark. I feel like it's really, I told Kyle the other day, I was like, I think this, and they told me, the surgery team said, the 6 month mark is really where you're going to start feeling less tied down by the mental load of the surgery. And the year is really where you can just kind of have a little bit more freedom, barring that no complications come up. So while I've not fully been able to transition into this phase yet of phase three, which is participating back in life fully. Some of you know on social media I've had some complications. I am genetically prone to kidney stones. So, of course, you're going to transfer a kidney to the other side of my body. How stressful. Of course, she's throwing a temper tantrum and throwing a kidney stone. So, I've been dealing with that for the past 2 weeks, 2, 3 weeks. So, that has not been fun, obviously. So I haven't been able to fully, I've still had to like cancel plans with people, not necessarily go full throttle on things. But I'm slowly working back into it. And as I stated, I was recently allowed to start lifting more, doing more cardiovascular. I am back on that stair stepper, but I'm doing it at a lower speed for like 5 to 10 minutes versus prior, I was doing a higher speed for like 25, 30 minutes just for comparison. So in a sense, I am returning back to life while still healing, which is a point I want to make, that the lines, again, between these phases are not always black and white. While I still consider myself, and I think my surgical team would as well, in phase two slash phase three, there are still fears associated with this phase, both of them, that I'm currently working through, such as, will I get back to what I was doing prior to surgery? Will I get the same? I mean, most of the weight that I lost was muscle mass, and I'm like, God, like, oh, am I gonna get back to that? Will I get back to my ski body? You know, like, will I be able to do the ski season this next year? Specifically, like a specific start of my story, I started to learn to snowboard last winter, and I absolutely love it. And I'm, not to brag, but I'm a bit of a natural at it. Barring just needing to practice and get more consistent with it. With that, I've been toying with whether I should just sell my board and my boots. And you might be like, well, why do that? Well, now that my kidney is in my left lower, like, or my right lower pelvic region, it's more exposed. It's not behind my kidneys. I'm a little nervous about all the falls because you do fall a lot more snowboarding than you do skiing while I'm learning to board. So, what happens if I take a nasty fall? Because I did last year and I broke my ribs. So, yay. And what if it does injure that lower kidney? What if I bruise it? So I'm scared to go back through another medical crisis like I just got out of. So with that, it's important that we don't just think to ourselves, oh, be brave and do it anyways. Like we're living in a new body and there's a lot to navigate now. And it is okay. Like I've been telling myself, some of me is like, no, go ahead and do it and lean in and don't let fear. I just, that's bullshit. Like let fear have a place at the table because to me, I'm living in a new body and I need to renegotiate my relationship to things I did before. And maybe it doesn't mean giving up snowboarding fully, but maybe it means not doing it this next season, sticking to skiing because I'm definitely a lot better at that. Rarely fall unless I'm doing something crazy. Maybe I just wait a couple years. Like keep, so like don't, it's not the should to, have to, ought to. I really hate inspirational social media. It's like, feel the fear and do it anyways. I'm like, you clearly haven't had your kidney relocated. Like, tell me you haven't had your kidney relocated without telling me you haven't had your kidney relocated. So those are the three different phases. And my hope in telling you about the three phase model of like your reaction to the injury, phase one to phase two, which is the cognitive appraisals of rehabilitation and working through that and all the fear that's there. And then your reaction to transitioning into life once you start getting released and what does that feel like? It's very raw, it's very vulnerable. So what phase are you in and how can you be gentle with yourself in that phase? And so my hope in telling you about these different phases is that you can see which phase that you're in and understand that you're still on the journey. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. I've had a couple of people reach out and say, wow, you're such an inspiration. Specifically, my fucked up, dilaudid self thought it would be a good idea to pursue comedy class. And I'll be honest with you, like, I think I jumped the gun a little bit too much. I was dealing with a kidney stone while I was in the class. I just had my first showcase this past Sunday, and it was wonderful. It really, really was. It was, again, I think I kind of was a little too excited to get back to life. Still great. I don't regret that I did it, but I've had a lot of people reach out and be like, "Oh, it's so great to see you like do living your life," and it gives me a helps me see that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and there is a life at the end of the tunnel. Everybody's journey is different, whether it's length of time in years and months, from the time of the diagnosis to the time of treatment, everybody's reaction to that surgery and potential complications that could arise or not. There's so much ambiguity and uncertainty, but just try not to get ahead of yourself. That's what I'm hoping that this three-phase model can help you, is to identify where are you at in the model. Are you in the barren wasteland of depression? And if you are, and I'm putting my hands over my heart right now, let's just accept that and love ourselves as well as we can through it. Are you in reaction to rehabilitation, and you've had the surgery and you're kind of in that vulnerable stage of, oh gosh, was that little twinge I just felt? Is that something going wrong? Just accept that that's where you're at. Don't try to be too far ahead of yourself, because when you do that, you're not compassionately showing up for your body in the space that it's in, and you're trying to force it into a space, and that creates tension. And so, where are you at? How can we love ourselves? I'll go into more in future episodes. I'll go into more specifics about these different phases and what you can do to show up for yourself. One other thing I want to touch on in transitioning into the stress injury model. So we just talked about the three-phase model, very macro approach. So which phase are you in? Now, the stress injury model is very much about three different factors that go into how you might cognitively appraise your response to the injury, your response to the diagnosis of Nutcracker syndrome. What this is composed of, and these three components are not siloed, they all interact with one another. And what they are is your personality type, your stress history, and your coping resources. I'll talk about these in like red, yellow, and green flags, is how I like to talk about it in class. So, again, these are not isolated variables. They very much impact, like, your personality type very much impacts your stress history, and the stress history impacts the coping mechanisms, and all vice versa. Okay, so just think of it like as a triangle, and there are bidirectional arrows in between each one of those. So, for example, my personality, like maybe others out there who can resonate, I wasn't necessarily born to a family of low anxiety. My genes were high anxiety through and through. And anxiety is done in two ways. There's trait anxiety, there's state anxiety. So trait anxiety is very much like your trait as a person. Like, do you have a high probability of having anxiety? I do. I'm genetically predisposed, on both sides. And then socialized into that as well, right? To see my family engage in this anxiety. So I was just like, hello world. Meet anxious me. And then state anxiety is dependent upon specific conditions. Like, do you, maybe you don't get anxious. Gosh, what would be a good example of this? Maybe you don't get anxious like walking into a coffee shop and ordering a coffee and sitting down to read, but you do get anxious giving up and giving a presentation. Like, that's state anxiety. So the different like conditions will cause your anxiety to spike based on what those conditions are. And I have just a general baseline of anxiety running through my blood. And then obviously I have medical trauma. Like, this is where stress history comes in, of, I had a brother who had a lot of medical complications growing up. So going to hospitals, like, I just had a lot of that trauma from a kid. And then it's being reborn into my specific state in my 30s. And I'm having to like grapple with that. I had brushed that under the rug all these years. And now I'm like, oh, great, here it is again. And now I'm having to like deal with my own diagnosis. So my state anxiety of just medical institution was being provoked. And so thinking about So for my personality, for example, it was really my primary caregiver that came in and was like, "How's your anxiety?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm fine, I'm fine," because I was thinking about my coping mechanisms. I was like, "I'm a psychology professor. I have all these tools that I use. I meditate. I did use yoga, but I can't even do that anymore." And he was like, "Well, would you just be open to taking this GAD-7 test, which is a 7-question general anxiety disorder?" And I scored severely anxious, and I was like, "LOL, that tracks." And he was like, "Would you be I could prescribe you some anti-anxiety meds." And at first I was like, no, I don't need those, because I had this implicit bias about needing medication. And then I finally came to my senses personally and was like, "You know what? Go ahead and prescribe me the middle of the road non-addictive buspirone. Let's start with a 5 milligram, see how that works, and then we can bump up if needed." And I'm so glad I did that, because my head was like, "You know what? I'll just go ahead and get him to prescribe it, and then I can just choose not to take it. Like, I have agency throughout this entire thing." And he agreed. So that helped me with my personality component, was like understanding what is your personality type. This also includes just like ADHD, different mental diagnoses that you can have. So it's not just, am I anxious or am I not? So are you prone to depression? I am. That was also another thing that I was genetically predisposed to. Love it. And do you, ADHD, ADD, are there other mental illnesses that you've been diagnosed with? So just think about your overall demeanor and how you show up in the world normally. And those things are going to influence how you react to the injury itself. And then that is going to intersect with your stress history. So again, I had already, not just my brother's stuff I spoke about, which I didn't realize as a kid. I mean, I just brushed under the rug, and now it was coming off. It was all coming back. All coming back to me now. But I also just had a year prior a major surgery, what I thought, LOL, was like the most major surgery I'd ever undergo. My hysterectomy, my loss of left ovary, my endo excision. So now I'm like, oh my gosh, I thought that was going to fix everything. And now I'm staring down the barrel of a transplant surgery. Like, what is this? So this stress history, which includes the amount of surgeries you've had, other medical PTSD, is also interacting with your personality. So I have to admit, my personality, red flag for this. My stress history, also red flag. You could maybe say they were yellow flags, you know, transitioning into a red flag. And then my coping resources. So the third interaction of the stress injury model is, and thankfully for me, because of kind of my wealth of resources, both from being in mental health therapy for years and throwing tens of thousands of dollars at that, because of my genetic predispositions to things, and also my work as a professor and teaching students about psychology, tactics, very much a green flag for me. So my coping resources personally really helped me mitigate the negative effects of the stress history that I have of my personality. I do not want to present myself as somebody who just had my shit together all the time. There were multiple times I broke out in hives, and had to have that addressed. So please do not think that I'm just some guru over here. If Kyle was here, he would definitely insert himself and say, "She definitely lost her shit multiple times." But I really tried to intervene with his coping resources. Like I said, I started a What Went Well campaign on social media, inviting others to do the same, those that were dealing with chronic pain, for us to highlight three things that went well each day. So we didn't lose sight of those positive things amidst the chaos. And that really did help me mitigate some stuff. I got a part of the Facebook group. I met some people that live locally to me. I started interacting with them. I had that support group there. I wasn't looking at Kyle to be everything for me, which was really challenging for him at the time. I had just moved in with him. I didn't have any friends locally. It was really, really hard. So the coping resources itself are, think mental health therapy, think any interventions like yoga, meditation, social support system. Okay. Now, something I want to talk about with the social support system when it comes to this stress injury model. And something that I talked about this a little bit in the how to support somebody with nutcracker syndrome. For example, I'm gonna be graceful with myself. My personality and my stress history are yellow flaggy, at times beige, at times red, you know, depending on the day. And my coping resources are green flag. Our social support also has their own stress injury reaction, meaning, let's take your parent. Let's take a parent, for example. What are their personality tendencies? Do they have a high trait anxiety, a high trait depression? Have they been diagnosed with bipolar disorder? Like, what is their personality, right? And then also, what is their state anxiety, especially as it pertains to medical issues? So, as an example, my family has had a lot of baggage from my brother's stuff, and then here I am in my 30s going through something very major, and that brought up a lot of stuff for them. So here they like you have your parent, maybe they have a yellow flag personality, red flag personality as it pertains to the stress injury model, interacting with your yellow red flag. So that could be fun. Then they have their stress history, right? You have a parent who they have their own medical trauma, they or not. I had some people in my social support that it was very clear they have not gone through anything medical at all. So they have no idea how to empathize. And a lot of it was just like toxic positivity. And I was like, okay, I can't with you. I mean, to be quite frank, I'm done with you, like, because their stress history or lack thereof was interacting with mine and in either validating or invalidating my experience and also their coping resources or lack thereof. So maybe you have people in your social support that should be in mental health therapy and they should have been their entire lives and they're not. And so their reaction to the stress history model is negatively impacting yours. So this is the foundation I wanted to provide you is first and foremost, which phase of the three-phase model are you in? The reaction to injury, the reaction to the diagnosis, the reaction of what's to come, and then that again, barren wasteland of depression as you wait, but keep yourself busy. A lot of people are like, no, hit it face on and don't distract yourself. Let's be real. Distraction is necessary. And I did that as much as I could. And one of the ways I did that was keeping myself busy, scheduling doctor's appointments, etc. Are you in phase two, the reaction rehabilitation? You just had your surgery and you're working through that. And then transitioning into phase three, the reaction to returning back to your life as a newly constructed person with both, if you do an auto transplant, both kidneys on your right side or your kidney lowered down in a hybrid, a new stent, whatever it is, you are now reborn into whatever version your body is now. So identifying where you're at and accepting where you're at, compassionately showing up for where you're at in that phase, and then also understanding that your stress injury response in the intersection of your personality, your stress history, and your coping resources will be showing up daily in all three of those phases. So to connect the stress injury model with the three-phase model is like for me, my stress injury model, like my personality was major red flag and my stress history was major red flag in stage one. In phase one, the reaction to injury, I was all over the place emotionally. And I needed to reel that shit in. And that was fine. I just needed to accept the fact that I needed to get off the rails and we'll get back on it. We'll go to therapy. We'll speak to Barbara. We'll engage with these coping resources. And then I felt like I was on the rails. I was doing pretty good. And then the surgery happens. And then we're back. Like my stress injury model's coming back in and my personality, my stress history, and all of that. And the unknown of inpatient. I've never done an inpatient before. So your stress injury, your personality, your stress history, and your coping resources are going, they're not a fixed state. They're very fluid. So you could have a flare day and your stress injury response kind of it gets into a red flag zone, right? So what do? We tap into the coping resources. The next episodes, maybe the next episode part two, I might do a part three. We'll see how it spans out. Who knows? We'll go into more of diving into the coping resource space. What can you do to help to dive into the coping resource toolbox and take a tool out to help you mitigate the negative effects of your stress history, of your personality, as it fluidly fluctuates throughout your three phases that you're in. I hope, because this is my day job. that this was a very beneficial episode for you, that you are seeing it kind of structured in such a way, and then the next episode helps and just kind of hits it home for you. If this wasn't helpful, then I maybe need a new day job. But anyways, thank you so much for tuning in. And like I've done before, and at the end of every episode, I want to invite you to just take this time to let's take that deep inhale in through your nose. Maybe even hold it at the top for just a moment, feeling that life inside of you, and then slowly exhaling, maybe even slower than your inhale, feeling yourself become more grounded in this moment. And then another deep inhale. And a slow exhale. Keep with that pace for as long as you need for the next few moments, or as you transition into whatever's up on the docket for the rest of your day. If you want to listen to the next episode of this podcast, or whatever you have on your to-do list, I am sending you major big hugs. Just know that if you're really struggling on feeling supported, that at a minimum, you have me. It's the whole reason why I'm doing this podcast. I'm extremely proud of you for showing up for yourself and doing hard things.